and women in our room tonight and listening later on NavaClub.org desperately in need will hear our speaker tonight, and we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing. Rusty comes to us tonight after 30 years of service. We are so happy to have him as part of the Naval Club. I don't know what it would be like without him. Everybody came expecting a big turnout, and that's what it is. And it's really a nice tribute. I'm Rusty Jones. I'm a very grateful alcoholic. And I've been told to speak up. Sometimes I get nervous, emotional, and my voice fails off. So, you know, let me know if you can't hear me. My sobriety date is February the 18th, 1982. Some 30 years and 2 days ago. I stumbled into the Atlanta Biscayne Room. Certified paranoid schizophrenic, prognosis poor. Barred from the Buckhead Mental Health Center for conduct unbecoming of the mentally ill. The first thing Alcoholics Anonymous promised me was that I never had to be alone again. And that meant quite a lot. Quite a lot. Because I had become the loneliest drunk in the world. I was raised right here in Atlanta by... My father was a Marine. My mother was a drunk. My grandmother was a Episcopalian. So, I had I struggled early figuring out where I fit in. I'm a misfit. I was a misfit then. I remained a misfit until I figured out how to become a part of this organization, which is what I'm still working on one day at a time. I grew up local, went to Northside High School, played football, ran track, did quite well as an athlete. High school, my drug of choice was competition, not alcohol, not drugs, competition. And that laid the foundation for who I became and what I became. And I grew up with far too much to prove. I was probably 10 years sober, 45 years old, somewhere in that neighborhood, when I realized that I had never done anything right in my mother's eyes. Never would. That was not something I was capable of doing, was something right in my mother's eyes. And until I got in these rooms, I had to learn, and I had to be told that was her stuff, not mine. But that drive, that too much to prove, I was a sophomore state champion in pole vault, and I still didn't quite feel good enough. I was a captain of my 8th grade football team, and that didn't make me feel a part of. Somehow I just wasn't. Nothing I seemed to be able to do seemed to be enough. My drug of choice is more. How much is enough, you know? And I deal with that
Yeah, that's kind of an ongoing thing with me. An attitude of gratitude is the only answer I've got to how much is enough. I mean, I never felt a part of it because I never tried to be a part of it. I was too busy proving I was better than to just be a part of it. I was a fairly poor student in college. I didn't go to college to be a scholar. I went there to be an athlete and prove I was better than the competition. My first real lesson in humility was being in the athletic dorm in college, among other high school state champions, state record holders, and all of that. That's what it takes to compete at that level. You know, if you weren't in that league, you didn't belong at the collegiate level. And I was also ran idea blutter. And that was, you know, when you're programmed to be the champion, it doesn't mean much to just Lutter. It should have, but it didn't. And going back just a little bit, and I don't do this smoothly. I bounce around sometimes. It's not a... I went to 8 different grammar schools. My father doing everything in his power to help my mother find some kind of peace and help her with her drinking problem. And he tried to... My father spent a lot of years trying to teach the rest of us to drink the way he drank. My father was a controlled drinker. He would drink a shot and chase it with water. And an hour later, he'd go have another shot and chase it with water and keep a little buzz going all weekend without ever getting drunk. I saw my father drunk once. I never learned to drink like my father. And I promised myself if I ever drank like my mother, I would never touch another drop. By the time I realized I was drinking like my mother, I couldn't stop. I had already crossed some line that the big book talks about where there was no choice. I basically drank for 14 years. I remember my first drunk being a blackout. I went to a fraternity party, bought a bottle of Usher's Green Stripe Scotch. I'll never forget it. I remember buying that bottle of scotch. I remember waking up sitting in the gravel, cold and alone, with about that much left in the bottle. Total blackout. Don't remember anything about the fraternity party at all. I mean, just knew something was wrong between me and the scotch, so I laid off the scotch and went back to beer. I was at this stage of my career as a drinker, I could handle beer, but the hard stuff was always trouble, always blackout, always out of control. First 14 years, no real consequences for my drinking, though I controlled it fairly well. Throughout college, I was a periodic. I was an athlete, so I was in training, so, But so I only drank with other people in training. We drank the way I drank. So nobody knew there was a problem there. After college, I was in the Marine Corps, where I drank with the nation's finest. And I only drank with people who drank the way I drank, so nobody could... There was no reason to believe anybody had a problem when everybody drank the same way, you know? That's... Anyway, that was after college, leaving college, I probably married, I guess, the only woman that didn't think I was totally insane for joining the Marine Corps. My father's a Marine. My older brother was killed in Vietnam. So my joining up was just the normal only thing I thought about doing. I postponed joining the Marine Corps when I got out of high school because I'd been offered the athletic scholarship to go to college and get an education. My father told me that when I talked to him about going to college, he said, I'm all for it. I think it's a great deal. I'm a great believer in education. You can get a good one in college. Or if you go, go. I'm not paying for it, but I'd love to see you go. That was his attitude. My senior year in high school, when I was awarded the athletic scholarship as pole vaulter, he became my greatest fan. He was with me 100%. And helped me cover the expenses of the scholarship bidding. It was a track scholarship, not a football scholarship, so it was a little, not quite the, but it was considerable at the time. After college, I went in the Marine Corps. As soon as I graduated, I graduated from college and went to OCS. I had my degree, so I was a candidate to be an officer. Got through OCS and went 6 months basic school, leadership training. I had some world-class teachers. That's great teachers in the terms of leadership by example. Command, don't demand respect. That helps in here, you know, when you're dealing with defiant people. So I had some great teachers out there. One of the best teachers I've ever had as far as living life and walking the spiritual path I've had in these rooms. And, you know, the essence of my story is I was successful. I set out to achieve everything I set out to achieve. I didn't let anything get in the way. I was a driven man. In 1979, at the age of 33, I owned my own home. I had my commission as a reserve officer. I was teaching school. I had two sons. My house and the car, my wife's car was fairly new. I was buying a new truck. Got the car paid for, so we're going to end up saying to go buy a new truck for me. And something went wrong. I got fired for reasons I'm still not clear on. I took a job I had gotten into computers in the Marine Corps. And I had been involved in the computer operations. And I took a job as a civilian, and it did not work out. And for the first time in my life, I was a failure. I was a loser. Well, the second time in my life, I lost the state champion my senior year in high school. I came in second. I was a loser. See. And I didn't associate that at all at the time with my mental health, this disease, or anything else. As I understand this disease, only an alcoholic finishes up in the state and feels like a loser. You're number one or you're nothing. Championship attitude. That's what I was taught. That's what I believed, and that's the way I behaved. And folks, that feeds this disease, as I understand this disease, in a big way. And I don't know that I could. I don't know that I could coach again, but behind. I don't know that I could ever coach again behind knowing what I've learned in these rooms about me and where it took me. I'm not saying there's anything. You know, there's a place for competition. I'm not opposed to competition, but I know where it took me. I know it worked on me like a drug. So it's something that. It's a good thing in its place, with a lot of other things that are good things. In these rooms, one of the things I've learned is the dangers of extremes. And the extremes to which competition took me was not a good thing. It was a form of spiritual pride, spiritual suicide. In February 79, I had a spiritual breakthrough. Notice I didn't say nervous breakdown. I said spiritual breakthrough. At the time, I was told I'd had a nervous breakdown. And I came out of that phenomenon. Certified paranoid schizophrenic prognosis poor. I was put on a drug called Haldol, which is some old stuff. Thank God for some of the improvements since then. But that was my first experience with that type of medication. I did not get it from a psychiatrist, and that's a whole other story. The better part of my story is not meat material anyway, so, you know. I'm skipping through it. And what Tim read at the first of this meeting is really critical. I'm up here to tell my story in a general way. And I'm up here to tell you how I found a relationship with God, as I understand God. That's the point of this. It's not to tell a drunk log. It's not to impress anybody with who I am, what I am, where I'm at, what I've become, or any of that, or where I've been, or anything like that nature. It's about how did I get from a total basket case to where I'm at today as a result of this program and finding a relationship with God as I understand God. And I do refer to God as God. My higher power is a concept. My God is an entity beyond my conception. And that's as far down that path as I go from the podium. If you have want more detailed information, that's restaurant material. Do the meeting after. Yeah. But you know, the meeting after the meeting has always been the heart of Alcoholics Anonymous to me. And the meeting after the meeting gives us a freedom that we don't have from this podium, where I have traditions to follow and NABA charter and all of that. It would not be my story if I left out the parts, the fact that there is another disorder involved. It just wouldn't be my story. And I know there are a number of other in a room this size. There's always some other dual disorder people that may get some hope from what I've experienced and where I've the method with, you know, I don't ignore the doctors today. I don't take myself off medication today. I've been taught that, you know, if a doctor puts you on a medication, you need to talk to a doctor about getting off of it. That's another form of, you know, if I'm taking myself off medication, I'm sponsoring myself, I'm playing doctor, and this is just too dangerous. You know, and this is... in my early sobriety, when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was basically came here having been told by another fellowship, just don't put anything in. So when I arrived at the Biscayne Room, February 82, I was coming off about 7 different chemicals, 6 of which was prescribed. The other one was called alcohol. And I had taken more than I should have. Another chemical called out of the end. And that was as high as I ever got on abusing alcohol and out of the end. It's a very dangerous combination. It's not, you know, it's self-medication. And, you know, I heard an AA meeting described once as a room full of amateur theologians learning the will of God one day at a time through the process of elimination. We should know what don't work. If we belong in these rooms, we should know what don't work. And if I know what don't work and I'm willing to try something different, I've got a tool. A lot of my early recovery was just that. I knew what didn't work and I was willing to try something different. Learning when to listen to the doctors and when to listen to the drunks was a real problem for me. And except for the guidance of a couple of psychiatrists who happened to be a member of this fellowship, helping me learn to referee the information to put together the information I'd gotten from the drunks and the junkies and the psychiatrists and putting it into a package that I could live with. And I don't listen to the doctors as well maybe as I should today, but I don't ignore them either. I'm still on medication. I'm on a chemical called Abilify for schizophrenia. I am now told by my current psychiatrist that I'm not schizophrenic. I never was. You don't recover from that. I don't have any issues to go back to the Marine Corps. And I've got the paperwork from the VA to prove it. See, so that's the deal on that. But, yeah, I came in these rooms and I was pretty nearly unemployable. And I had worked my way from Marine officer to yard man. And that wasn't what the corporate arena was looking for that year. They were looking for somebody who might have reversed that, but, you know, that doesn't look right on the resume. The little path that I took in route here just didn't, you know. And my information on computers and communications and all that became pretty out of date pretty fast when I got out of the field. I have yet to return to the field. My information is I'm a total dinosaur now. And some of you know, and some of the science is how quick you can become. We used to call them dinosaurs. Just totally out of date, out of touch, and antiquated information. Anyway, I got sober driving a taxi for another alcoholic who became somewhat of a dad to me. Great guy. Had me tremendously. But he gave me a job when nobody else would even consider hiring me, much less putting me behind the wheel. The odd man job just fizzled. I didn't get fired, I didn't quit. They just did some rearranging when I had about 4 months in the program, or 3 months or something like that. I was engaged when I came into the program. And I was basically told that what a seeking was seeking its own level. And that she was a great gal. And but she had her issues, I had mine, I had to and it didn't work long term. She had to go her path, I had to go mine. I still have the utmost respect for her and the lovely mother of my children. I didn't come into these rooms referring to the lovely mother of my children as the lovely mother of my children. I hated her. Anyway, I learned to respect who she was, and as a result of getting into this, what I was taught with the process, the path through the steps, the journey to finding God, the journey to the relationship I now have with God came as a result of that process. It wasn't, I came in these rooms a drunk and a junkie looking for a quick fix. You people taught me to trust the process. And that pretty well summarizes the whole deal, the different mentality that saved my life. I'm still a drunk and a junkie looking for a quick fix, but my priorities are entirely different today. My motives may not have improved much, but my priorities have straightened out. And I know today, sober by the grace of God, the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and my priorities. We don't talk about it a lot in these rooms, but there's an earned part of this deal. There's an earned part of this deal that all boils down to and is summarized in my being willing to practice the priorities and the principles that you people have taught me. My recovery began when a lady with a lot of time simply asked me what I was doing to participate in my own recovery. And I had no answer. I had no answer at all for her. But she sat there and she simply asked me, what was I doing to participate in my own recovery? She didn't care what the doctors had told me. She didn't care what I was diagnosed. She didn't care what kind of medication. She didn't know about that. She didn't care about that. That wasn't the way she was. That wasn't who she was and where she was at. What was I doing to participate in my own recovery? And I didn't have a recovery because I didn't know how to participate in it. And I was taught something as simple as the first word of the first step, the we. I was promised I never had to be alone again, and the process started. And that, from that point forward. And there's a big difference between my best thinking and my independent thinking. My independent thinking is after I've consulted with you guys. I had a sponsor who taught me, Rusty, there's nothing best about my independent thinking. And there's nothing independent about my best thinking. We hear that taught in a number of different ways. My thinking versus the we thinking. First word, my independent thinking is still tends to be dangerous. It still tends to be self-destructive. I still do a lot of meetings for a lot of reasons. The default settings on this instrument, some of them ain't right yet, not 30 years later. I get to thinking on a tangent. And I've got it all figured out, and I'm thinking I know what's best for me and everybody involved. And I've got you people to help me interrupt that tangent and get some focus back into my life and my priorities and the grace of God. And where's God involved in this scenario? So, take God out of the scenario, and I'm... So death wasn't my fear coming into here. And then I was told a number of years ago by my sponsor that I was more afraid of life than I was of death. That's what separated me from so many other people that I tried to understand out there. I had a whole different set of fears. The earth people were more afraid of death than they were of life. I was more afraid of life than I was of death. And I look at my track record and all of where it took me and all of that. And I've come to realize there's a lot of truth to that. What scared me into... I was afraid of being put away permanent. Death didn't scare me near as much as being put away permanent. And another sponsor told me I had the potential to spend the rest of my life in a little rubber room talking to the insects because I didn't know how to communicate with the doctors. That got my attention. I remember sitting on the taxi stand coming up on 4 years, somewhere along in there, and not getting where I thought I was supposed to be on my schedule. I wasn't getting it together the way I saw so many other people that I was getting sober with, getting the job I thought I was supposed to have, or the car I was supposed to have, or the situation, or the fiancé I thought I was supposed to have, or whatever. It wasn't happening on my schedule. And up on that same taxi stand came a gentleman from the room. He'd been sober quite a while. And I told him about how miserable I was. And I asked him, what are you doing wrong? And he simply said, Rusty, I'm at peace with my priorities. I'm sorry you're not. I'm not too concerned about theirs. That's their problem. And he had learned to make peace with his own priorities and let other people do the same thing. Everybody's going to walk their own path. But what I realized after a while was that he had the sanity, serenity, sobriety, recovery, respect, and happiness because he made peace with his priorities. And I started changing my focus, not immediately, but long term behind that, into stop chasing after things and making peace with my priorities. There isn't the first material promise in the big book. Not one. Not one. It's a totally an inside job. But as I learned to practice these principles, as I learned to be me and make peace with my priorities and let other people worry about their own, I started functioning, even in the corporate arena. I got out of the taxi, and after about 6 years, and went into the labor pools. I still couldn't put together any kind of resume that made any kind of sense from part of a master's degree and a commissioned officer to taxi driver. That doesn't, you know. Yeah, I don't know what you do with that kind of resume. It didn't. But I got one of the better jobs I got that I've had in the life, working out of a labor pool. Some of these temp agencies have connections with some pretty good companies. And I went temp to perm and had a permanent full-time job on a disability pension, 9 months trial work program. It went pretty well for about 9 months, and just I got a little too close to management. I got a little too close to politics. It brought out the worst in me. And once again, I got fired. And now, there had been other, you know, that was, I think, the first time I'd been fired. So I'd been fired drunk from the computer job. I'd been fired. I went from there to police officer, where I got fired. Or I didn't make probation. Don't get fired as a police officer. You just don't make probation after 6 months. Same results is I had a wife, two kids to support, and she wasn't back then. Like, you had a couple of kids, and somebody had to stay home because daycare was more than she would have been earning. So it was all on my salary to keep things afloat. So that, you know, I went and started a little construction company as a subcontractor. Went from there to school teacher. This was all, you know, leading up to the psychotic break, which was all wrapped up in who was I, what was I, where did I belong. I was a misfit. That was the essence of the dilemma. I didn't know that at the time, and I was, you know. One of the critical things I've learned, and I'm running out of time here, is through this me, a layman, debating psychiatric diagnosis with psychiatrists. That's fruitless. They can call it whatever they want to call it. They've got the license. It's their responsibility. I don't have to believe everything they tell me, but I can let them do what they have to do on paper. For whatever reasons, they have to do it on paper. Thank God for the absence of paperwork in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, if you had to, you know. No, nobody ran a background check on me to see if I could join this club, thank God. Alcoholics Anonymous has given me a great life. Officially, as of last month, I turned 66, which means I am no longer disabled. I am retired. Which means I don't have to work part-time anymore. I can work full-time because I don't have that income restriction. What you people have done with my life, and the priorities you've taught me, the tools you've given me, have enabled me to function not only in these rooms, but in the corporate arena. You notice I didn't call it the real world, I call it the corporate arena. You know? Because to me it is an arena. I found my reality, I found myself, I found my family, I found a lot that I love in these rooms. I was on the internet this morning, or last night, this morning, sending out a, checking, well, last night I sent out an email to my daughter-in-law over the, I'm back in, you know, don't have a lot of contact, but I have two sons, four grandchildren in Mississippi. Another son in Mississippi living with his mother, and I wish I had more time with them. I wish I had healthy relationships with them, but that's I was out of their lives for a lot of years, and I can't go barging back in. But we are communicating, and we're working it out. I did make one trip to Mississippi to meet my four grandchildren a couple of years ago. That was nice. I hope to do that again soon. You know, it's a struggle when you've been out of their lives for so long. It was always too soon, or too late, or too this, or too that, and there was always some. My recovery had to come first, and they had their lives moved on, and the amends my beloved mother and my children wanted from me was me out of the picture, working on me, healing, recovering. And I gave her that. And now it's, maybe it's time, maybe it's too soon, maybe it's too late, who knows. It's a God deal. And one thing I have learned, I have to learn over and over in these rooms, is it's all His timing. It's not my timing, it's God's timing. And things work out the way they're supposed to. I have my family of choice in these rooms. And I thank all of you for being here and giving me a chance to let you get to know me a little better. Don't assume you know somebody in these rooms if you're simply aware of their reputation. It's a very dangerous thing to just be aware of somebody's reputation and not know what you're dealing with. Most people tend to shy away from what they don't know what they're dealing with. And here we must talk, give everybody the benefit of the doubt and time to eliminate it. And we do that. If you're new, and a lot of you are, I love you, and I wish you a long, slow recovery. Thank you.
Thank you, Rusty. They were out of gold watches, but they did have that cupcake there. And we hope you enjoy every bite of it. Tinsley is going to hand out the chips.
My name is Tinsley. I'm an alcoholic. Thanks, Rusty. You're such a gift to this fellowship. And we love you very much because you make us feel loved. Here at this meeting, we have a chip system to mark our time away from our last drink. If you'd like to try this way of life one day at a time, we offer a white chip. Would anybody like to pick up a white chip? for your service. Anybody else want to pick up a white chip? After 30 days, we have a silver chip. Anybody want a silver chip? Red chip for 90 days? Anybody else got 90 days? Yellow chip for 6 months? Green chip for 9 months? Birthdays. Who's got a birthday?
Years. And this is not something I've done. This is a symbol of what we have done that I couldn't have done.
Anybody want to reconsider on a white chip? Big hand for the chip you hold.
Thank you, Tinsley. If there are no further announcements, I remind you that anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions. Every mind is placed principles before personalities, and for those who will, to join hands in the Lord's Prayer. Who always makes a great meeting?
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
Just another homesick child, tired of running wild, ready to stand trial and move on. Though I'm guilty in your sight, ask for mercy tonight. I can't make it through this fight all alone. But oh Lord, don't make it easy. Keep me working till I work it all out. But please, please, won't you shine enough light on me till I'm free from the shadow of doubt. Keep me out of the shadow of doubt. As I try to make some sense of this world I'm up against, well, I know my best defense is your love. When the struggle gets its day and the lessons fall of pain, keep me calling out your name with love. But oh Lord, don't make it easy. Keep me working till I work it on out. But please, please, won't you shine enough light on me till I'm free from the shadow of doubt. Keep me out of the shadow of doubt. Whisper in the dark from the bottom of my heart, and I'm searching for one star to shine. I was reach out from mountain high, and I'll reach into the sky till you open up my eyes so blind. But oh Lord, don't make it easy. Keep me working till I work it on out. But please, please, won't you shine enough light on me till I'm free from the shadow of doubt? Keep me out of the shadow.